This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, France has a new president, Emmanuel Macron. The 39-year-old former banker comfortably secured 66% of the vote in the final poll announced on Sunday. But with over 25% of French voters abstaining in the election, was the real winner apathy? Commemorative events across Scotland will mark and celebrate the close links between the people of Scotland and Russia. But how important are these events in keeping alive the memory of past generations who came together to defeat fascism? With the UK's local elections out of the way, it's full steam ahead with the general election. And we've got all the latest from today's campaign trail and snot, bogies, boogers, dried nasal mucus, whatever you call it, it's official that eating it, according to scientists anyway, is good for you. All that and more over the next hour on this Monday edition of World in Focus. In the end, it wasn't as close as predicted, with Emmanuel Macron winning 66% of the vote compared to his rival, the far-right candidate Marine Le Pen's 34%. But the real winner of the race to become the next president of France appears to have been apathy, with over 25% of the French electorate abstaining, the highest abstention rate since the 1969 presidential election. But Macron's victory was also notable for the bitterness displayed on both sides during the campaign. So where does France go from here? Our reporter Mark Hurst has this.
Not since Napoleon has someone so young led the Republic of France. Emmanuel Macron's election as the next president of France was widely predicted. But will his victory over Eurosceptic Marine Le Pen lead, as Macron promised during his campaign, to substantive reform of the European Union? Whilst pro-EU politicians will be sighing with relief at the outcome of the French presidential race, other analysts are warning the result is far from a ringing endorsement of the European political elite. French voters strongly rejected the traditional mainstream parties during the campaign, with almost half of all French voters opting for the anti-EU candidates during the first round of voting. And there are early indications senior political figures within the European establishment, notably the current European Parliament President Antonio Tajani, that the surge by Le Pen and other populists across Europe should serve as a warning for the EU to reform or face a growing backlash. As Macron addressed his supporters in front of the Louvre Museum in Paris, he urged them to continue to act boldly.
Today, we have conquered a right that places an obligation upon us. You have chosen to be bold, and we will continue boldly forging ahead day after day, because this is what the French people expect us to do, because this is what Europe and the world expects France to do. They're expecting France again to be able to astonish them, for France to be France again. And that is what we shall do.
Meanwhile, his presidential opponent, Marine Le Pen, told her supporters that France had chosen continuity and that magnanimously she had contacted Macron to congratulate him on his victory.
My fellow countrymen, from continental France, from abroad, from overseas, the French have chosen a new president. They voted in favor of continuity. I have called Macron because I have the best interests of France in mind, and I wanted to wish him the very best. And I wanted to thank the 11 million people who have voted for me.
Le Pen went on to claim her place and that of her party, the Front National, as the official political opposition in France, and that her showing in the election meant a new recomposition had taken place.
Through this historical decision, the French have chosen our alliance as the first force of opposition to the new president. The political parties who took the responsibility of electing Macron have in fact brought discredit upon them.
Le premier tour,
and the first round of election has shown a major decomposition of French political life through the elimination of the old parties. And the second round organizes a recomposition, a political recomposition based on the division between the patriots and those who are in favor of globalism.
By contrast, Macron chose to address Le Pen's supporters directly. As he mentioned her name, his supporters began booing. But Macron quickly moved to stop them, sensitive to the deep divides that have opened up across France during what has often been a bitter campaign.
And finally, a word to Madame Le Pen. All those who voted for Madame Le Pen tonight, they expressed tonight, don't boo her, they expressed tonight their disarray, they also expressed their own commitments, which I fully respect, but I will do everything in the next 5 years to make sure that they understand that there is no reason why they should continue voting for the extremes. Tonight, there are only French men and French women, the whole of the people of France standing together. And what you represent here tonight in the Louvre is fervor, enthusiasm, the energy of the people of France.
Although Macron, a former banker and economy minister under previous French President François Hollande, has said he wanted to drive reform of the EU, he may yet face a strong backlash. Many EU members are focused on dealing with issues of migration and security, and any fresh steps to increase the powers of the EU may be perceived as a diversion to these concerns. So where does France go from here? Well, earlier I spoke with Alistair Cole, a professor of European politics at the University of Cardiff. Professor Cole, this has been a fairly acrimonious presidential campaign. Macron and Le Pen both called for France to reunite in their speeches after the result was announced. How difficult a task will that be?
Well, I think it's going to be a little bit difficult, given that the animosity of the second round. I mean, the debate on the Wednesday preceding the second round was a most extraordinary acrimonious affair. And if we think about Macron, I mean, in a way, Macron's been elected with what appears to be a very large majority. But in practice, the abstention rate and the spoiled ballots were very high. A lot of people were clearly not happy, actually, with the choice between Macron and Le Pen. The sheer political violence, really, of the exchanges that those two candidates has left a rather bitter taste for many people, for many French electors. So I think, in a way, it will be difficult to restore. However, it will be easier for Mr. Macron than it will be for Mrs. Le Pen. I think that Mrs. Le Pen really is in a pretty difficult position now, whereas Macron, clearly he has the political initiative, he's young, he's been elected president, and so in a way, people are looking on him to take a lead fairly quickly.
President Macron has said he wants to significantly reform the European Union, but are his proposed reforms that include giving the EU more powers likely to be supported among the other EU member states?
I think it's interesting in the sense that Macron was the only candidate in this presidential election who was explicitly arguing for more European integration. In answer to your question, some states will support that, some clearly won't support it. I mean, one can imagine states in Central and Eastern Europe in particular having some difficulty with that. But if one looks at the finer detail, that's interesting here. It's really based on reviving a Franco-German relationship at the heart of Europe. But the main issues raised by Macron, and particularly close parliamentary control over budgetary policy, are not necessarily those that the Germans will be enthusiastic to embrace. So I think, you know, beneath the political discourse of harmony, there'll be some real tensions with Macron as president.
And some of his critics have suggested he's too idealistic in his approach to the EU, given the rise of populist movements, as you imply, and the perceived need by some EU leaders to claw back that ground. Where is he likely to face problems in terms of the EU member states, specifically what countries?
Well, I think he's clearly got off not necessarily on the right foot with the countries, well, with both Poland and Hungary. He criticised before being elected president. Clearly, he would also have, with the UK, whether this is still a pertinent debate is another question, but clearly with the UK and with Brexit in mind, Macron will not be a particularly easy character. He's made it clear that he thinks that, you know, the European Union shouldn't give much away, really, to the UK. But I think, in a way, on the other hand, it's clear that there was enthusiasm from Germany, enthusiasm from Italy, although Italy faces, of course, its own problems that are likely to come to the fore soon. So I think, in a way, Macron, he's in a pretty powerful position to make important, substantive, and perhaps especially symbolic moves over the next few months in terms of closer European integration. But, you know, the hard bargaining, as always, will throw up difficulties, and that national preferences will be borne in mind by all players.
How well placed is Front National following this election? Can Le Pen lay legitimate claim to being the official political opposition in France now?
I think it's understandable from her perspective. She polled over 10 million votes, which was twice as many as her father had done 15 years earlier. On the other hand, the result was slightly disappointing. She was expecting to get over 40%. And when one looks in more detail at those results, it would seem as if Marine Le Pen came first in around 50 constituencies that the FN might win in the forthcoming parliamentary elections, which would be a great feat. But, you know, a parliamentary group, even with 50 members of the National Assembly, would still be well behind, I would say, the Republicans, who will are shaping up, getting over the disappointment of not having François Fillon in the second round, are shaping up, and they ought to perform quite well, really, in the forthcoming elections.
And has Le Pen successfully offloaded the political association and the political baggage of this connection, obviously, with her father? Is that something that she has achieved during this election?
The answer to that would be yes, until the campaign in between the two rounds. And really, the campaign in between the two rounds was extraordinary to observe. The second week, and particularly the presidential debate, she really didn't cut it faced with Emmanuel Macron. I think she lost her nerve a bit, and in a way, she appeared to be going back to renewing many of the far-right accusations against Macron. But so I think, in a way, her attempt to normalise the strategy wasn't very convincing in between the two rounds, and clearly that makes her open to enemies, to critics within her own party. She didn't succeed in making the FN like any other party.
And lastly, almost half of French voters appear to have rejected mainstream traditional parties. Is that level of disgruntlement that we've seen in France with the kind of political elites, the previous mainstream political parties, is that in line with the kind of populist movements we're seeing across Europe at the moment?
Yes and no, to some extent. It's an equivocal answer, but yes, clearly, because almost, as you rightly pointed out, not far off 50% of those voting on the first round supported candidates who were extremely critical of the existing establishment. The two main governmental parties, the Socialists and the Republicans, neither of them got through to the second round, which is quite an extraordinary occurrence. So clearly there's a strong foundation there of distrust. On the other hand, the parties, there's a very big difference between, let's say, Macron and Le Pen on the second round. And I think, you know, Macron has an opportunity now. It might be the last opportunity, I don't know, but he has an opportunity to really grasp control again, to recreate that project, that old project of a centre in French politics that can represent two French people out of every three. Whether it's an illusion or not, time will tell, but it's certainly an old aspiration amongst the centre in France. So, and for once, actually, the centre appears to be in command. So we'll see, we'll observe with interest what's going to happen.
Professor Alistair Cole, many thanks for speaking to us today on World in Focus.
Thank you.
That was Mark Hurst reporting there. And Mark Hurst joins me in the studio now. Mark, is this the end for Marine Le Pen and Front National?
Well, Jack, far from it. The far right has suffered defeat in Austria and the Netherlands recently, but there are a number of indications the far right march to power in Europe is far from over. I think it's fair to say that Le Pen had hoped to run Macron much closer in this contest. There were some predictions she would take as much as 40% of the vote. She had strong campaigning slogans such as Save French Civilization and Take France Back from the Clutches of Globalization, but in the end it wasn't quite enough. But where she did draw support from was by tapping into fears over high unemployment, immigration and the threat from Islamic extremists. But where she appears to have fallen down in terms of this campaign was on her commitment to leave the Eurozone. That proved quite unpopular in the end. But the defeat of Le Pen is being seen by a number of analysts as a stumble rather than the annihilation of the political right in Europe. The populist right in Europe remains very buoyed by the decision by British voters to exit the EU, and Donald Trump's success continues to resonate strongly right across the right-wing level of support in Europe. One Brussels-based political think tank, Tenio, has pointed to the real influence of far-right movements, who they say exert influence not by necessarily taking government or becoming, winning elections and taking power, but constraining the room for manoeuvre by traditionally centrist parties. The Le Pen result is far from a crushing blow sustained by her father in 2002, who was heavily defeated by Jacques Chirac, but equally it's lower than I think she was hoping for. However, where Le Pen will take real comfort from is that this is their best ever result in a presidential race for Front National in its 44-year history. I thought it was interesting to hear her point to the new fault line in French politics now, which she says is not between right or left or right and centrists, but between what she described as patriots and globalists. However that pans out, though, there's clearly a significant base of right-wing support in France that is going to have to be something that progressive or more liberal politicians are going to have to deal with.
Just briefly, Mark, because we don't have a huge amount of time left, but the European markets appear to have reacted surprisingly negatively to the election of Macron. What's behind that?
Well, yes, I mean, the Eurozone stock slipped today, and the euro actually dropped from a six-month high against the dollar as investors began to ponder what Macron's promise to push through these economic reforms might mean for them. I should stress, though, that the movements on the markets have been fairly modest, as there is a great deal of speculation over whether he can actually achieve the reforms he promised. I think what we're seeing here is initially some relief from the financial markets when the markets actually went up immediately after the result, but then there was a kind of, oh, wait a minute, this guy wants to bring in reforms that could have a detrimental impact on us further down the line. You know, I think it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen there over the next few weeks.
Well, let's keep an eye on there. Thank you very much, Mark.
We are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Coming up on the programme, commemorative events across Scotland will mark and celebrate the close links between the people of Scotland and Russia. But how important are these events in keeping alive the memory of past generations who came together to defeat fascism? We'll have more in a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Can augmented reality technology become a threat to our privacy? Why did Google abandon its Google Glass project? Learn about the history of augmented reality from early 20th century science fiction novels to 1980s experiments with iTap devices to the virtual realms of modern Microsoft HoloLens headsets. All of that and more in our new series, Parallel Universes, How Augmented Reality is Changing People's Lives, this week on Radio Sputnik. From June 1st to June 3rd, state officials and decision makers from top Russian and global companies are gathering in St. Petersburg for a one-of-a-kind event. St. Petersburg International Economic Forum 2017 is set to welcome over 12,000 participants from 133 countries and feature discussions on most pressing issues of today, all under the aegis of its core theme, achieving a new balance on the global stage. Top government figures and leading experts from all around the world are meeting at the biggest platform for international discussion. For more details, head to www.forumsbb.com.
By any means necessary is your guide to the movement and efforts shaping the world around us. From mass incarceration...
No longer am I interested in or concerned with prison reform. I am interested only in the eradication of prisons.
To the battle between police and water protectors.
It was a pretty punishing disregard for the sanctity of human life that unleashing water cannons on peaceful, prayerful water protectors
From efforts to protect the environment.
The climate movement is ready to, with plenty of opposition research and force and strength, along with, you know, the right of both science and morality to fight them on this.
To the movement for Black Lives.
When I first saw the Michael Brown video and I saw that it clearly contradicted the narrative put forth by the Ferguson Police Department and by police supporters in general, three words came to mind. Color me shocked.
Stay tuned to By Any Means Necessary, 5 days a week here on Radio Sputnik.
What are we to make of Trump's first 100 days in office? A president who entered the White House promising to roll back from years of disastrous foreign wars and military interventions ended this all-important initial period in power as one of the most hawkish and interventionist US presidents of modern times. And if this is the first 100 days, what can the world expect in the next 100 days of the Trump administration? Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Brave New World.
Most baby boomers were once rebels, members of the generation that saw the first music festivals like Woodstock and Glastonbury. They believed in liberal ideas like the concept of one world, personal development. Does the new nationalism that we see rearing its head around the world threaten all that? And will the new nation-centric policies take us back to the conservatism of the 1930s? Tune in to this week's Brave New World.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, commemorative events across Scotland will mark and celebrate the close links between the people of Scotland and Russia. But how important are these events in keeping alive the memory of past generations who came together to defeat fascism? And snot, bogies, boogers, dried nasal mucus, whatever you call it, it's official, apparently, that eating it, according to scientists anyway, is good for you. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 22 minutes past the hour. Throughout May, Scots veterans of World War II will take part in joint commemorations with Russian counterparts in a celebration of the joint role both countries played in defeating fascism during that last global conflict. But how important are these events in maintaining the good relations between the two countries? Our reporter Mark Hurst has this.
A series of commemorative events will take place across Scotland throughout May, marking the military cooperation between Britain and the former Soviet Union during the Second World War. The events will be centred around the 9th of May, Victory Day. The 9th of May is the date on which the USSR formally announced victory over Nazi Germany in 1945, following the Great Patriotic War, when Germany formally surrendered to the Supreme High Command of the Red Army and the Allied Expeditionary Force. Victory Day continues to be celebrated internationally and remains a powerful reminder of how East and West united to defeat one of the most brutal and deadly regimes in history, the Nazis. During the Second World War, Scotland proved a vital staging post in supporting the Soviet Army following the German invasion of the Soviet Union in June 1941. 78 convoys, known as the Arctic convoys, sailed from ports in Scotland, Iceland and North America between August 1941 and May 1945. The convoys ran the constant risk of being sunk by German U-boats, and the bravery of their crews became legendary. 85 merchant vessels and 16 warships were lost during the hazardous operation to supply the Soviet army and keep the USSR in the war against the Germans. Almost 4 million tons of supplies reached the Red Army through the Russian ports of Archangel and Murmansk. More than 3,000 Allied servicemen lost their lives in the Arctic convoy operation. And in July 2014, the Russian Federation began awarding the veterans the Medal of Ushakov in recognition of their bravery and courage shown during this mission. Well, earlier I spoke with Mr. Andrei Protsepov, the Consul General of Russia in Edinburgh, to discuss the importance of this and the other joint commemorative events taking place across Scotland this year. Mr. Protsepov, there are a number of commemorative events taking place throughout the year. Why is it important to remember and commemorate these events, highlighting the mutual cooperation that existed between Scotland and the USSR, especially during the Second World War?
First of all, I will outline the old saying that those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. And I think it's one of the proudest pages now in our shared history, and both our countries should be proud of what our grandfathers have done to win the war. And again, it's an excellent example of what we can achieve together by joining our efforts.
And I know you've been very involved in the efforts to commemorate the role played by the Arctic Convoy veterans. Having met many of the veterans myself, it's clear they feel a very strong bond between Russia and the UK. Can you tell me about the response you've received from the veterans who've received the Medal of Ushakov, and a little background about the significance of that particular award?
Yes, I think it's very significant. I think I was actually blessed by this mission to present the Admiral Ushakov Medal to the veterans, and I've been doing it personally, presenting them with their long overdue reward, and the reaction is very significant, and it's quite clear that the medal means quite a lot for them. One son of the veterans wrote to me that my father had never really come to terms with World War II, and along with other veterans was quite bitter that what he has done haven't been recognized. And when my father received his medal, I saw a big change in his views regarding his time in the war. I now saw a man full of pride, and he began to talk and reflect on his time in convoys. I'm indebted to you for helping my father with come to terms with the actions of himself and his comrades in the war. So I think it's meant quite a lot for those people who actually, after so long time, came to terms with their own life.
Because many of the veterans were campaigning the British government for many years to get recognition, but it took the Russian Federation to finally get that, and many of them were very emotional, I recall. There are other commemorative events, though, taking place, highlighting the links between Scotland and Russia. And how important is it to keep alive the memories of Russian and British military cooperation that was essential in defeating the Nazis during World War II?
To my view, it's even more important today to show that the Brotherhood in arms can solve the problems of the modern world, the challenges we are facing now, like the threat of terrorism. And if we cooperate, nothing could be impossible for us.
And how would you describe the current state of relations between Russia and Scotland?
Actually, it's a wider picture. It's more relations between Russia and Britain. Being a diplomat, I would rather say that I have seen better times.
And there are many cultural and historical links between the two countries, but which one stand out the most for you?
So for me, it's very important what the veterans of the Arctic convoys done for both our countries. But Scotland plays a very special role for quite a lot of Russians because of your poets and writers. Robert Burns, almost as popular as the most famous Russian writers. So the link between our poets is like a special bond between our hearts. So that's why I think those poetic and historical links so important. I will give you just one example. So there is a competition in creative writing called Pushkin Prize, established in 1988 by great-granddaughter of Alexander Pushkin, one of the most famous Russian poets. And the prize is traditionally given to students aged 12 to 15 years who submit their work, literary works. So this competition will celebrate its 30th anniversary next year. And throughout its history, more than 65,000 school children from Scotland and Russia, mostly from St. Petersburg, became its participants. Among the winners of this contest are leading British politicians, scientists, doctors, and of course, writers. So I think this competition illustrates a very good, the not just cultural, but a very spiritual links between Russia and Scotland.
And finally, could more be done to promote these links between Scotland and Russia? And where do the commemorations in particular, highlighting the joint cooperation between the two countries during the Second World War, where do they fit into that?
I think these celebrations and commemorations, they cement the basis, the platform for this, for the future relationship between Scotland and Russia. And it stands as indispensable chapter in our shared and proud past. So building upon this basis, we can achieve quite a lot. And we are thinking that the special bonds between the museums of the Arctic convoys could be established as a strong network in our bilateral relations.
Mr. Andrei Protsepov, Consul General of Russia in Edinburgh, many thanks for joining us today on World in Focus.
Thank you very much for having me.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Coming up on the programme, with the UK's local elections out of the way, it's full steam ahead with the general election, and we've got all the latest from today's campaign trail. That's in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
We're all doing together. You ready? Are you ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hi, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Doubling down.
What are we to make of Trump's first 100 days in office? A president who entered the White House promising to roll back from years of disastrous foreign wars and military interventions ended this all-important initial period in power as one of the most hawkish and interventionist US presidents of modern times. And if this is the first 100 days, what can the world expect in the next 100 days of the Trump administration? Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will kill myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs program, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
What evils lurk in the hidden corners of the World Wide Web? Find out how hackers attack Dash propaganda with antidepressant ads. Learn about the future of digital currency. See how an unsuspecting soccer mom's smartphone can be turned into a zombie robot. Follow the special series, Dark Web in the Shadows of the Internet, right here on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, with the UK's local elections out of the way, it's full steam ahead with the general election. And we've got all the latest from today's campaign trail. And snot, bogies, boogers, dried nasal mucus, whatever you call it, it's official that eating it, according to scientists anyway, is good for you. Now, in the run-up to any UK general election, it's pretty standard to have lots of regular opinion polling, even daily opinion polling, giving us as clear an idea as possible as to just how the electorate might vote come the big day. What's pretty unusual, though, is to have a poll that's potentially as far-reaching and detailed as the election itself, just 5 weeks out from a general election. But that's exactly what happened last Thursday. The UK-wide local elections for 35 English local authorities and all counties in Scotland and Wales did just that. Now, of course, we have to be careful in not reading too much into the results. It was under a very different voting system, the issues weren't identical, and turnout is likely to have been much lower than for the general election. But as a snapshot of the mood of the UK electorate just 5 weeks out from the scheduled election in June, it's probably a good indicator. Theresa May's governing Conservative Party saw an increase of 8% in its vote, whilst Jeremy Corbyn's opposition Labour Party was down 4%. The UK's fourth largest party, the Liberal Democrats, were up 3%, and the Scottish and Welsh Independence parties, the SNP and Plaid Cymru, saw little change. For a party that's been in government a whole 7 years now, the Conservatives will be pretty happy to see their vote share increase. It's an indicator that Theresa May's dogged attachment to the Brexit cause has worked for her, and the total destruction of UKIP, the foremost pro-Brexit party in the UK, who retained just one seat at last week's
2006 council elections, losing a whopping 145 nationwide, will be music to the ears of the Tories, who have been losing support to UKIP for years now. So, with a weekend to recover from those local results, it was full steam ahead with the general election campaign again today, beginning with Theresa May, who gave a speech in London as she launched her team of candidates for the area this morning. The phrase, strong and stable leadership, may feature more than once in this clip.
The local elections are now behind us, and we must now focus on the critical general election. And we cannot take a single thing for granted. And this is the team that will be going out on the streets and taking out on those streets our positive message, which is a message of strong and stable leadership in the national interest, of strengthening the UK's hand in the Brexit negotiations, of building a better future. Now, yesterday, a new French president was elected. He was elected with a strong mandate, which he can take into as a strong position in the negotiations. The UK, we need to ensure we've got an equally strong mandate and an equally strong negotiating position. And every vote for me and my team will strengthen my hand in those Brexit negotiations. And the alternative is to risk making Jeremy Corbyn Prime Minister. And just imagine, try and picture him sitting at that negotiating table with the collective might of the European Commission and 27 other European countries against him. And we know other parties are lining up to prop him up as in a coalition of chaos, the Liberal Democrats, the Scottish Nationalists and others. A vote for any other party is a vote to be a step closer to Jeremy Corbyn sitting at that Brexit negotiating table. We must not let that happen.
UK Prime Minister Theresa May speaking on the election campaign trail this morning. Now, the big policy announcement from the Conservative campaign today was the intention to retain their manifesto commitment to bringing immigration down to, quote, the tens of thousands. It's an odd pledge in some ways, especially given that it's one the party has broken already, having featured prominently in the party's 2010 and 2015 manifestos. Taking questions from the press, she was asked about the policy, which many of her own colleagues have said is unworkable, and whether she was committed to the ending of free movement as soon as the UK exits the EU.
Let's look at why we have a net migration target, why we have said that it's important to reduce immigration, to bring control into the immigration figures. It's because of the impact that it has on people, the impact it has particularly on people at the lower end of the income scale, and in terms of the pressure on public services. So I think it is important that we continue, and we will continue to say that we do want to bring net migration down to sustainable levels. We believe that is the tens of thousands. And of course, once we leave the European Union, we will have the opportunity to ensure that we have control of our borders here in the UK, because we'll be able to establish our rules for people coming from the European Union into the UK. That's a part of the picture we haven't been able to control before, and we will be able to control it. And leaving the EU means that we won't have free movement as it has been in the past. And when it comes to voting on the 8th of June, people have a very clear choice, actually. It's between a Conservative Party, between me and my team, who are committed to ensuring we bring back control of our borders, and Jeremy Corbyn, who just wants to carry on with free movement as it always has been.
So there you go. That's all very clear then. Theresa May speaking in London this morning there. The Liberal Democrat leader Tim Farron was headed to Scotland today, where he's hoping to win back some of the seats his party lost to the SNP back in 2015. Whilst he was travelling up the country this morning, he spoke with Sky News on board his party's battle bus, where he was asked about Theresa May's immigration pledge.
The sensible thing to do with immigration limits is to have immigration rules that benefit the country. And having fixed targets, Theresa May should have learned this by now, the number of times that she's failed to meet her own targets as Home Secretary. Having fixed targets is just foolish. You do it for political reasons, to try and appease the odd newspaper, but actually what you end up doing is hurting British business. Our hospitals, our universities, what our employers need, what our country needs is a migration policy that benefits Britain, not benefits a politician.
The Liberal Democrat leader, Tim Farron, speaking with Sky News this morning. Now, the Liberal Democrats got just under 5% of the vote at the 2015 general election, a major drop from the 23% they polled in 2010. It saw them losing 49 seats in Parliament and drop from the third party to fourth, a defeat which has largely been attributed to their ill-fated decision to go into a governing coalition with the Conservatives back in 2010. Current polling does consistently put the Lib Dems at around 10%, which is still a far cry from where they were just a few years ago. Indeed, there was even a short-lived period during the 2010 election where they were polling ahead of everyone. Tim Farron is therefore likely to preside over a slight improvement in his party's fortunes, but even he isn't talking up the prospect of anything more than becoming an opposition party.
Across the whole of the United Kingdom, the Liberal Democrats now growing into that space that an official opposition really ought to be, providing an alternative to the Conservatives. Let's be honest, we're heading for a Tory landslide on the 8th of June. Britain deserves a strong opposition.
Liberal Democrat leader Tim Farron speaking to the BBC earlier today. Now, every day in a general election campaign, all of the parties try to capture the narrative with big policy announcements in the hope that they can get everyone talking about their particular positions and maybe catch their opponents off guard. Today, the Conservatives were focused on immigration, as well as obviously strong and stable leadership, of course. But Labour was talking about the National Health Service. It's a contentious subject in UK politics, given the widely held view that the Tories are keen on creeping privatisation of the hugely popular state-run health service. And Jeremy Corbyn's big policy pledge for today was the scrapping of hospital parking charges in England, or as he put it, an illness tax. And sticking with that health theme, Labour also wants stricter rules on advertising of junk food to children in a drive to tackle childhood obesity. The Labour leader met with student nurses at the University of Worcester Nursing School in the southwest of England this morning, where he spoke with them about the difficulties facing the profession and those training to work in the NHS.
Well, it's counterintuitive not to train more, because we do have an age profile problem amongst doctors as well as amongst nurses. And if we don't train more, then that problem just gets worse and worse. You end up working longer and longer hours, and more people as agency nurses, which is both expensive and insecure. It's not a great way of doing things. So we are very clear that we want to lift the pay cap, because essentially most NHS staff have in reality had a pay cut over the past 7 years, so you can negotiate proper wages and conditions. We want to bring back the nurse bursary so that those that wish to go into nursing can do so without a great debt at the end of it. And we also want to improve health issues. So we have announced today about the way advertising is intensive on young children of extremely unhealthy foods. And as we all know, if children are fed unhealthy foods from a very young age, then unfortunately that becomes a life choice and goes on for a very long time after that. So that's important. And then the other one is just about your jobs and your security. So we want to make sure there's proper staffing levels in hospitals, enforceable staffing levels, which are not done at the moment. And also just something that's probably very important to all of you, car parking charges in hospitals. Because it's crippling. It's crippling to you, because you need your cars to get in because of the hours you work, and obviously for visitors as well. And so we are, we've worked out a way of funding that. Everything we offer is totally funded, but we're very, very keen on it, because I'm totally passionate about National Health Service. My auntie was one of the first NHS nurses. She qualified in straight after the NHS was set up in the 1940s, and then she ended up becoming, whisper it quietly, a hospital matron in Devon. But she was so proud of the NHS and so proud of being a nurse. And I've never forgotten, as a little boy, going to visit her in her hospital, that she came out with this massive uniform. I was dead frightened of her.
The UK Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn talking to student nurses at the University of Worcester Nursing School in southwest England this morning. Also on the campaign trail today was the pro-independent Scottish National Party leader Nicola Sturgeon. Buoyant in the wake of her Scottish local election victory last week, she visited a brewery in Perth with her party's candidate for the area, Pete Wishart. And UKIP still licking their wounds after losing all but one of their council representatives last week, saw their leader Paul Nuttall subtle, arguing for a somewhat simplistic immigration policy of, quote, one in, one out.
I can announce today that UKIP will go into this election with a policy of balanced migration, which means zero net immigration over the next 5 year period.
UKIP leader Paul Nuttall there. Also today, Caroline Lucas, the co-leader of the Green Party, has said that she wants to enter talks with Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party with a view towards forming a progressive coalition in opposition to the Conservatives, which would involve, in effect, not standing candidates against one another in specific constituencies. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the Labour leader has not expressed any reciprocal interest. But it's worth remembering that Caroline Lucas currently holds the only green seat in the country. A deal of sorts has already been made, though, with the Liberal Democrats, who have decided not to field a candidate in Caroline Lucas's Brighton Pavilion constituency so as not to split the pro-EU vote. And so another day goes by in this roller coaster of a general election campaign. It's now just 30 days to go until Brits take to the polls for the snap general election on June 8th. Theresa May still appears to have a commanding lead in voter intention, but with opinion polling steadily ebbing away at that lead, the confident veneer of Theresa May's campaign will be masking a quiet nervousness as we wait for fresh polling this week. If new polls continue to show a trend against that Tory lead, then perhaps a progressive coalition led by Jeremy Corbyn might be looking less and less fanciful with each passing day. We shall see, though. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
Radio Sputnik.
And finally, in the UK, we'd probably say snot. In Scotland, bogey might be more common. Or if you're American, booger. The technical term is dried nasal mucus, and it comes out of your nose. We all knew someone when we were children who picked their nose and ate it. Indeed, some adults still do it. Maybe you do it. Maybe I'm doing it right now. I'm not doing it. I'm definitely not doing it. But scientists have now said that parents shouldn't discourage children from eating their own snot because it contains, quote, a rich reservoir of good bacteria. And according to the American Society for Microbiology, eating bogies can actually prevent bacteria from sticking to your teeth or defend against respiratory infections and stomach ulcers. Plans are even in the pipeline to develop a toothpaste which mimics the health benefits of snot. Something to look forward to there. Personally, I think I might just take my chances. That is all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. You'll be relieved to hear. Don't forget you can listen again to this and to previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we'll be handing over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartmann Show. Until tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Tom Hartmann. This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Technology can be a great help to humans, but in the wrong hands, it can cause harm. There are computer programs that keep ER life support machines running, and there are also viruses out there that can damage data. Your files and your programs disrupting the vital functions of your PC's operation system. Learn more about the first computer virus ever created and the modern-day Trojan horses, worms, and ransomware. Listen to our new series, Ghosts in the Machine, the history of computer malware, this week on Radio Sputnik.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.
This is Radio Sputnik.
What are we to make of Trump's first 100 days in office? A president who entered the White House promising to roll back from years of disastrous foreign wars and military interventions ended this all-important initial period in power as one of the most hawkish and interventionist US presidents of modern times. And if this is the first 100 days, what can the world expect in the next 100 days of the Trump administration? Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Technologies and human capital, global economic trends, rise of artificial intelligence, and a whole range of other international issues are at the top of the agenda of St. Petersburg International Economic Forum 2017. From June 1st to June 3rd, the event is hosting B20 Forum and Valdai Club, as well as business dialogues between heads of companies from Russia, United States, France, India, and Latin America. To learn more about these and other major items on the program, head to forumsbb.com.
Brave New World.
Most baby boomers were once rebels, members of the generation that saw the first music festivals like Woodstock and Glastonbury. They believed in liberal ideas like the concept of one world, personal development. Does the new nationalism that we see rearing its head around the world threaten all that? And will the new nation-centric policies take us back to the conservatism of the 1930s? Tune in to this week's Brave New World.
Wondered what's at the root of the best creative collaborations? New York City graffiti artists, Hollywood movie directors, famous writers and their students reveal their secrets. You'll discover why the Coen brothers edit their own movies, putting a made-up editor's name into the credits, and how Edward Snowden teamed up with Jean-Michel Jarre to warn the audience about the dangers of mass surveillance in a fast-paced techno music video. Listen to our new series, Creating Together, The Art of Collaboration, this week on Radio Sputnik.
Every day we ask questions.
Were you not surprised that somebody executed Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr?
Well, do you see this as being a human rights violation?
Are the cows really stinking up the planet that much?
To move ideas forward.
A gravitational wave is a ripple in the fabric of space and time.
I don't think the launch of the satellite proves anything at all.
Where do good ideas come from? We connect with independent thinkers, hear their ideas, and create stimulating debates on real issues.
The Dow is in a correction. As I said, commodities across the globe are collapsing. Why is that the case? Because we are in a global recession.
That is set to change because Iran has approximately about 50 million barrels, which it had put in storage during the height of the sanctions regime, and that's ready to be released as soon as possible.
Where is the money?
The super rich individuals and the world's biggest companies are able to hide money in tax havens.
Is there a solution to the crisis?
No, because I don't think anything useful has come out of any of the policy reform discussions with respect to financial reform.
They give us answers we aren't always prepared for.
This recession will be even worse than it was in 2008.
But that would be the nasty way for it to happen, you know.
But because of Guantanamo, the U.S. is no longer taking so many prisoners. So instead of taking prisoners, they kill people.
They aren't always prepared to answer.
What are the exact technicalities of this offer by the European Union to Turkey, Jim?
I just love the way you asked that question. What are the technicalities of an EU offer? The answer is, of course, a classic EU fudge.
Well, I'm a diplomat, Jim. You know that.
Absolutely.
Welcome to the show.
Hello, Abdul. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm smiling.
How are you?
Thank you very much. Pleasure talking to you.
Always a pleasure talking to you as well.
Hello, Abdul. How are you?
I'm fine. Hello. Although the views which I express are not necessarily the views of the editors, but one thing you will agree with me.
You know, with that said, we've had our fun, I guess. Is it time to get serious?
So you think we really should take this warning 100% seriously?
Welcome to the party.